Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. In this episode, I sit down with actor, author, musician, humorist, and woodworker, Nick Offerman. I'm not usually exhausted by a guest before I even sit down to talk with them, but Nick Offerman may be a first. It's not just that he does so many things, but that he does them at such a high level. It's inspiring, and honestly, a bit intimidating. There's the acting, of course. He's probably best known as Parks and Recreation's Ron Swanson, but he's also written 3 books, performs stand-up and live theater, and operates a serious woodworking business. As a young lad, Nick dabbled in rebellion against his small-town, community-oriented values, but that was never really going to work. Not only were they too ingrained, they were actually just what he needed to survive in a business he says can be pretty gross. In this episode, we talk about his start in theater, courtesy of the Catholic Church, and we also talk about how and why he got into writing and the story behind The Founder, his fascinating new film with Michael Keaton. Before we get into it, a few episode spoilers. You will be entertained. There will be some profanity. Social and cultural issues will be discussed. You might also discover the real secret to living the good life. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Nick.
Hello, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
My pleasure.
You know, when I was researching for this conversation, I got a little bit intimidated because you do so many things. You are a actor, director, author, woodworker, purveyor of fine meats. It's intimidating. And then reading your books, I think they're really inspiring. I like your writing.
Thank you for the nice compliments. It'll relieve you to know that I too have decided I do too much.
Really?
And in the middle of writing this new book, my third book, I had an epiphany that the reason I chose the topic of woodworking for this book was to trick myself into slowing down. For the last 5 months, I've said no to every job.
Really?
So that when my calendar runs out, which right now is early November, is when I'm booked through, I'm gonna get back in my shop and slow down, because it's been really fun. And it's weird, as an artist, you know, I think you're always hoping that your work, whatever it is, will just have an effect and reach an audience. And I've just been really lucky in this spate of years where I've had a few different things reaching an audience. And it was great, load up the calendar.
Right.
Let's go on tour, let's write a book, let's shoot a thing. And then that was really fun. And after a few years of it, the wake up call was last year. We got an email from our travel service that said congratulations, you've taken 176 airplanes this year.
Really?
And Megan and I, my wife, were just that's not healthy. That needs to change. So next time we do this, I'll have much less for you to look at.
Good. We'll book you again when you're doing nothing. Yeah. And we'll just sit here and look at each other.
I'll have perfected some card tricks.
Well, it is funny hearing you say that, because I grew up with a father who had pretty much a 9-to-5. He was in the garage after dinner every night and all weekend. And the consistency, I think that he probably didn't get on an airplane for 13 years of that span.
Wow.
So that pursuit of craftsman, that world, that life, I think doesn't always mix with someone who's globetrotting and this full plate that people seem to have now.
Sure. You spend so many years, especially as an actor, trying to get the top level of material, if you get cast in a show, that's great. But then, you get cast as Horatio and you're like, this is amazing. But now I'd really like to play Hamlet.
Yeah.
And then you get cast as Hamlet and you're like, okay, well, this is great here in Cleveland, but I'd really love to play Kansas City or maybe even Topeka. It'll never stop if you don't stop it yourself, because you'll play Broadway and you'll say, well, what about the West End? And then what about the moon? I assume.
Yeah.
There'll be a great Shakespeare stage on the moon soon.
Eventually. Well, okay, but take me back to the moment when you decided, okay, I'm going to write a book. I think Paddle Your Own Canoe is your first book, right?
Yeah.
To me, it's a philosophy book in a lot of ways.
And it's not a traditional memoir at all. And I would think to be able to write a book that expounds upon your own viewpoint in life and your own philosophy, it's one thing to have a philosophy, it's another thing to be able to articulate it and organize it. Like, what was that process like for you?
Well, the answer is funny, because we were talking about our mutual friend Rashida Jones earlier and paying her some compliments that she is always due. I had this organic thing happen when Parks and Rec started and people liked it and found an affinity for my character. Colleges began to invite me to appear as though I were a stand-up. It's funny. A lot of the audience seemed to think that I was Ron Swanson, like that was my shtick, like Michael Richards kind of is Kramer.
Right.
Obviously, I'm not that manly. but colleges began to invite me, and at first I said, no, I'm a theater guy. I'm not a stand-up. I don't do that. And then something clicked, and I said, how many kids are we talking about? And they said, I don't know, 2,000. You know, it's an auditorium. And I said, let's book it. There's some things I want to say to the young people. And so then I'd written a couple songs to play Megan, to like make her laugh. And so with my songs and my philosophy or my agenda, I wrote this show, which became American Ham, which is like my first humorist special. And I was playing it at Largo, and Rashida came, and she came backstage and said, you know, I really like your show. I love that you're not just telling jokes, that you have an itinerary, like you're trying to achieve something with your audience. It sounds like you're reading from your book.
But you didn't have a book at that point.
Correct.
Okay.
And I just had an absolute light bulb where I thought, you know, there's a ton of stories that I couldn't fit into this 90-minute show that I think are great cautionary tales, stories in which I'm a jackass, mostly in the distant past, but some more recent. And so I called my agents and said, hey, could I look into getting a book deal? I think I could take a swing at this. And so I wrote up a proposal, and it was born of that first show. And so I certainly, you know, I have organized thoughts because as an artist, that's kind of my constant mission, which sounds boring and gross, but like that's what I'm thinking about. Is I look around the country today, and it's easy to, for example, the crazy political situation we're in. It's so easy these days to be completely partisan and be red or blue and just call the other side an asshole. But it occurred to me around the time of my second book that's not doing us any good. We'll never gain anything from that. And I began to think maybe it's something we're being sold in this consumerist time, that maybe the people in charge are perfectly happy to keep us blindly watching Fox News or The Daily Show or John Oliver, so that we're just like, you're an asshole, and we all vote, and meanwhile, they're destroying the planet. having sex with their daughters, from what I read in the New York Times. And so my second book, my first book I was really proud of, and it was really fun. But when I read it afterwards, I thought it's very prurient. There's a lot of bad language and like college stories, you know.
Sex, you apologize to your mom a lot.
Sex and weed, yeah. There is. There's a lot of apologies to my parents, who are so nice and decent. And so for my second book, I try to be very fair, because even in the first book, I'd say, look, I'm down with all religions. If you go to church, I don't have a beef with you in any way. I just want to look at some of the things that are being done in the name of religion that I think are not holy, that I think are human, that, you know, for example, like trying to get prayer in schools or do things that are just not fair or American.
Right.
And I try to examine those, and I still get a lot of angry responses from church-going people that have these knee-jerk reactions. And I say, well, okay, I failed in reaching these people, because the choir that I'm preaching to, they agree with me. I don't need to convince them to be nicer to gay people or whatever, you know, my
sure.
issue is.
Sure.
And so in my next book, I tried to then, and it's a constant thing, like, how can I make everybody laugh and get across what I think is just simply decent without alienating the people who I'm trying to like bring over to the side of just simple.
You don't want to speak just to your tribe, in other words.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would be easier. I mean, I could probably write a whole show of fart jokes. That would be a lot of fun. And even involve some brass instruments.
some trombone.
Yeah. Some trombone, some French horn. You'd be surprised.
Yeah. How about the flugelhorn?
Flugelhorn would be just a cameo in Act Two.
Yeah. No, but I understand what you're saying, and I think that when I read your book, the experience I had was I was very clear on where you stood. But at the same time, you made a real effort to be decent and fair, and in some cases, I guess, you have to take a certain segment of the population and go, okay, you're just not going to play along.
It's true, there are such hot-button issues, which is, I think, part of the way that we're manipulated by the political system, like issues like abortion or gun control, where as soon as those come into the conversation, people put up their fists, where they're
right.
Like, oh, we're gonna talk about this? I know where I stand, because Bill O'Reilly told me where I stand, or who, you know, whoever. And so that's just, you know, to me, it's interesting as an artist to try and, you know, if I can bring 10 people over, if I can make 10 knitters out of Pokemon Go players, I'll feel like I've achieved something.
Yeah.
It's weird. I never expected to write books or perform as a touring humorist. But since I had the opportunity to do it, and I have done it and really enjoyed it, it's made me say, okay, well, I don't think I'm not as funny as these funny people, and I'm not as smart as the smart people, but I've got some attributes of both of their ideologies.
Now, is that really true? You see yourself that way?
Sure. I mean, I'm very aware, like that's something, if you sat down and tried to write a 350-page book, which usually is a 400-page book, and somebody smart cuts out 50 bad pages.
Right.
At least for me, I love reading. And when I write, I'm so aware at what a terrible journalist I am or what a bad scholar I am. It's all I can do. Like Gumption, for example, you know, I'm writing about Ben Franklin and Frederick Douglass and Eleanor Roosevelt. And I can easily come up with the 20 to 30 pages of interesting, poignant, salient material on each of them. But I'm so aware of the gulf of information that I don't have time to get into.
Well, that's what I found with Gumption. I found that it's sort of like when you love an author and you want to tell somebody and you want to pick the right book to start them on. And same with these subjects you picked.
Well, I'm intensely grateful that you, it's very rare to be in an interview setting with someone who's A, even read my books, but B, has has gotten what I'm going for.
Well, so, I'm hoping to be in your fourth book.
I'm gonna.
You know, I mean, I was mentioned in Gumption, but could have used a chapter.
We'll see. Book four may be about religion.
Then I'm out. Then.
Well, we'll see. You
unless
never know.
I can play the antagonist role.
Maybe I'll hire you as a heavy to accompany me into, you know, some sort of temple or local. You know, we might go to some cult situations where I need some backup. I hope it doesn't come to violence. I generally say hug before punch.
You do.
Because I'm ready, like I'm built to punch.
Yeah.
And part of the reason that I made that motto is because I'm made to like beat the shit out of people. And at the same time, I have an artist soul. And so I'm always reminding myself, be like, no, don't let things get you so mad that you let the animal out, you know? Because that's what I think, you know, ultimately we'd like for all mankind is like, hang on.
Yeah,
how can we figure out this apple situation without blowing each other up, you know?
Well, you know, you say you have this artist soul and inside this, I mean, you describe in your book how you were just ferocious on the football field as a tackler.
I don't think I would have used the word ferocious.
What did you use? You used
I was definitely a vicious.
Vicious, yeah.
There was a moment where I was the most violent tackler. I was the headhunter of the football team.
Wow.
Of Minooka, Illinois.
You know, it brings up a thought about
that was the pinnacle of my virility in my life.
Yeah.
And now I'm basically Baryshnikov in the body of like Taggart from Beverly Hills Cop or Midnight Run.
But you know, you think about like the randomness of a kid trying to find, like we have really poor methods of research and development as a kid, right? And I think often about the randomness of finding something that you love. Do you ever think about, well, maybe I could have missed discovering acting or discovering that I did have an artist's soul?
Well, it's interesting. It's a great question, and I think about it a lot because that's kind of my jam. Everything I do seems to be somewhere in the realm of encouraging people to make things for themselves. Because there's so many things you can make. You know, I make furniture or a canoe, but you can make music or food or buildings. There's so many things you can make, and I feel like that's my soapbox in this sort of modern industrial consumerist society is like, you guys, there's so many things that will make you feel better than shopping. We've been taught that like shopping is something to do. Like, what do you want to do today? Well, should we go to the park? Nah. Do you want to go to the mall and possibly buy things we don't even know right now? Like, it's a pastime.
Yes.
Like going to the zoo, you go to the mall and like, oh, let's buy these cute shoes that you don't need, etc. And so, you know, I don't have the answers to these big questions, but I do know that I encourage people to have a work ethic. And in my new book, my woodworking book, I talk about this, that when I was a kid, I had all these guys, my dad and my uncles and my grandfathers, teaching me to use tools. And I say, I want to be very clear, I was never good at using tools. Like, they taught me to use tools, and it was one of the worst things. We'd be building a pen for the hogs or a doghouse or a porch, and I'd be helping, and I'd be hammering a nail, and they'd stand there and say, hit it. And I would hit it as best and hard as I could, and they'd say, no, hit it. And I'd be like, what? I would be so frustrated and emasculated until finally, years later, I finally could hit a nail, you know, sink a nail with one blow. And by that time, they weren't there because they had seen that now I could be trusted to nail something together.
Right.
And the thing that I think is important is that woodworking, a lot of what I do, I didn't know about it as a kid. I didn't know that I would love it later in life. And so I think it's more important. I love taking kids and trying stuff out with them. Like, hey, do you want to try, you know, going for a bike ride? Do you want to try knitting? Do you want to try all this stuff to see maybe if there's something that they cotton to? Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But I think what's most important is the caring involved in that. If you make an effort to, you were telling me about taking your girls canoeing.
Yeah.
That, just the act of doing that is teaching them that there are things to do besides go to the mall or escape inside our gadgets, you know? And that to me, so that when I was in my 20s and I began to earn a living as a carpenter, then it all came home to roost. But, you know, when I was 22, 21, I never would have guessed that I would love using a chisel when I was 28.
Well, it's been well documented that throughout your history of starting a theater company and working on the stage, that you've also done makeup, you've done set building, you've done fight choreography. And I think it's noble to meet an actor who didn't just sit around waiting for jobs and didn't sit around, you know, with a bunch of other actors waiting to be successful actors. I mean, what's fascinating to me is that when I read your book, I go, this guy came from a place where nobody acted, nobody understood what it was, to the point of where, if your book is to be believed, you were not aware that you could earn a living being an actor.
I mean, I would have guessed that You know, Eddie Murphy got paid for Beverly Hills Cop, but I wasn't aware that professional theater was happening. I wasn't aware that that a route to a career in acting could be theater school, and then in Chicago, for example, people were getting paid to be in plays.
Well, what was the moment where you go, oh, I like performing, I like being on stage?
I didn't have an epiphany or a light bulb moment. I think I grew up a ham. I think I, on the altar of the Catholic Church, where I was an altar boy, and then eventually I started doing the readings of the gospel in a position called the lector. I think, and then my high school did plays, you know. But it was around then that I was aware that I wanted to entertain people. And I got a couple laughs in church. And it was never cognizant, like, ooh, this is like showbiz, I'm gonna try something. It was just naturally screwing around and mugging.
Right.
And I did a bit, I was the altar boy and I had the water and the wine for the priest. And these two crystal, what are called cruets, these little bottles, and you hand them one and you hand them the other. And I just took a whiff of the wine and just made a face at the congregation and got a laugh. And I was like, hey, that's pretty good. And then my dad, of course, informed me that that was not the place to get a laugh.
It's pretty good, though.
Monsignor Seidel was a sweet old man. He didn't see much. But it was rife with comedy. Like, he would glug out the whole thing of the wine and then take the water, boop, and do one drip, and then like chug this huge thing of wine. The whole thing seemed really funny to me. But it's interesting what you were saying about, like, I didn't sit around waiting, you know, to get acting jobs. It goes back to, that's what I brought, that's what I'm so thankful for from my family, was when I got to LA, that was the worst time. I came with some other friends, some contemporaries from Chicago theater, and everybody was like desperately trying to get their foot in the door wherever they could. And that involved a lot of waiting. And so you'd either go to the coffee shop during the day or the bar at night, or the bar during the day for a couple unfortunate souls. And it only took a minute to see that. And these guys are like, oh, I'm so neurotic, like, it's so hard, you know, waiting for my big break. And I, just because of my upbringing, I was like, oh, okay, I need to leave. This is not how one should spend one's time.
So you were able to retain like a sense of who you were, even in LA. You didn't want to throw off completely who you were.
No, I mean, it was ingrained in me by my family. So when you reach a point of stasis in your, you know, hopeful career, and there's nothing to do. Like, you're waiting for the phone to ring.
It's the hardest thing about being a self-made person in Los Angeles in the arts is to know what to do with your time in those years in your 20s, right?
Totally.
I think that there's a lesson in being in the present that's very hard to be when you're in your 20s wanting to be somewhere else.
Absolutely. And you fill your life with so much, you know, reading all of this guidance of here's how you, you know, get to where you want to be. And it's taken us... This is a record for how long I've gone into an interview before I bring up Wendell Berry.
But I was going to bring him up. You didn't.
It all comes back to Wendell Berry, where that's, and it took me. I mean, it's. I want to be clear that, you know, I was a jag-off. I mean, I was like trying to enjoy myself. I mean, part of me thought that was part of the artistic journey, was like, I had to smoke a lot of weed, or I had to like have these experiences like Jim Morrison or something, or like I was in a David Lee Roth video. And eventually, one of the reasons I was so moved by Wendell Berry's writing was it reminded me of my family and my home community. And what I eventually came to realize was that while you're waiting for the phone to ring, or, you know, for things to take off, how you spend your time will affect if the phone's going to ring or if things do take off. And unbeknownst to me, so I had the wherewithal, for example, I really couldn't stand going to commercial auditions, and eventually I quit because I could either work as a carpenter and make, you know, $16 an hour or whatever. Okay, that's 4 hours. I know how much money that afternoon is, and I'm, you know, I'm improving my skills.
4 hours meaning by the time you drive to an audition, sit, wait, and do it, and drive home, it's 4 hours.
Yeah, a commercial audition invariably was usually about half a day. And, you know, commercial auditions don't really involve, they don't care if you went to theater school. It's like, who has the right vibe? You know, who holds the beer can the best? And so it's a real crapshoot. And so once you realize that, and you're in a room with like 80 guys, and you're like, I don't have anything up on these guys, you know?
Right, it's a lottery.
It is.
It's if the art director pictures you as the guy who's aspirational, but yet an everyman that feels Midwest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you ever hear him talking when people leave the room, it immediately tells you the story where you leave the room and they're like, that guy was great, but I wish he had brown eyes. Or that, you know, that guy was great, but he's, what is he, 6'2"? Oh, man, if he was 6'4", he'd be perfect. And it's so superficial and you're so objectified that it doesn't, anything that is your artistic worth doesn't matter in that room. It was that very notion that then made me say, you know what, I'm just going to work with my tools. And little could I have known that eventually, that was the craziest thing about Ron Swanson, was that the writers said, oh, we love this woodworking thing you do. We're going to, can we put that in the show? And I said, sure, I would be thrilled to have you come shoot at my shop and have that be Ron's shop. And crazily then, the time, what I did to fill my life while waiting for acting jobs, then sort of serendipitously became part of my acting jobs. And now I'm known, it's weird, now I'm known as both a woodworker and an actor, because my woodworking is not, I always get accused of being like a master woodworker. I'm not. I'm proud of my work, and I do decent work, and I'm a student of it. I'm still learning. And I say this in my book, in my woodworking book, early on I say, let me make something very clear. I'm not a master. In fact, I profile 8 masters. Masters are people who spend their lives devoted to mastery.
Right.
And I'm a dancing jackass. Like, it's funny, people ask me around the country, like when I'm on tour, they're like, what are you working on in the shop? I'm like, I'm here in Detroit fucking farting on your stage. I'm not working on anything in the shop.
But I think it takes a lot of gumption to be able to close a door, like to say, I'm not going to do commercial auditions anymore. Because especially in Los Angeles, I think conventional wisdom would say, you just take every opportunity you get and something will break through.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how did you develop that sort of confidence to be able to say, I'm going to say no to things when I'm still not working full time?
It's a good question. It's just a gut feeling. I felt like, you know, I know what my strengths are as a performer. And for example, I kept auditioning for the original CSI show. We're in Los Angeles, and 30, 40 minutes up the road is Valencia and Santa Clarita. That's where they shot the show. So anytime you'd get an audition, you had to drive. It was kind of like at least half a day, sometimes a whole day, just to go audition for CSI. A procedural show that are not my bag. You know,
right.
It's a good paycheck if you get a week job, but it's not the kind of material I wanted to be doing. And I kept going up there to audition because I'm the type to play a serial killer or a rapist or, you know.
You just look like a serial killer or a rapist?
I'm the whole package. Like, wait a second, it was the guy driving the bus, and I can drive a bus. And so after a handful of these auditions, then my agent would call and say, hey, you got an audition for CSI. And so I was never getting the job. And I said, they tape every one of these auditions. Can't they look at my 5 tapes, my 7 tapes? And they're like, no, you know, they really like you, you know. So I went the 8th time and the 9th time. And finally I said, you know what? No more CSI. I'm not going, like, if they call, I'm not going. They can offer me a job, but I'm not. I've spent, you know, dozens of hours trying to get on this show that is not my bag.
To be a serial killer.
To do something crappy. And so that was a big deal for me. That was the first rule I made with my agent, where I said, no more CSI. And then things began to follow, where I understood that even if I got a nice job on one of these shows, it wasn't going to take me where I wanted to go. I don't like those kind of procedural shows. And the people who are doing the work that I like aren't going to give a shit. No matter how good I was on CSI. And so it was just a gut thing where I said, you know what? I want to try and make my life happy. And I did that a lot more by meeting Megan and, you know, creating a home with her and getting married and having my wood shop and just, you know, enjoying my friends and my community.
Were there ever times when you wanted to quit?
I don't think so. I always had a feeling when I first got to Chicago, I wasn't very good, and I knew it. I hadn't figured out yet, like I hadn't come to zero. I was still, I was trying way too hard. I could tell that I wasn't good at acting, that I was. And in 1993, I did a play with my company, the Defiant Theater, in which my best friend was our genius director guy. And he would always, we'd do these plays, and we were best friends. We were in love, like the best of friends. And we would do a play with a perfect part for me, and he wouldn't give it to me. And be like, Joe, what's up? Like, I'm your best friend. He's like, yeah, but I have to cast the best person. I want the play to be the best. And I understood, and I was grateful, and I knew he was right. I knew that, you know, I had the wherewithal to be like, all right, well, I wish you would not cast the best person sometime.
Was that a discovery time for you of trying to figure out, well, what is it? Why am I not the best person?
Totally. Like, I absolutely wanted to be great at acting. And I went through a whole, like, high-quality theater school, not learning it, you know? And it had nothing to do with my classes or what I was reading or learning. It all had to do with how I saw myself and how I brought myself to the craft.
And how was that related to growing up the way you grew up?
That's a good question. I feel like I grew up being taught decency and hard, good work ethic, and I bristled against it. You know, I dabbled in indecency quite a bit. I, you know, my parents were such good citizens that I was like, well, let me see if I can push the boundaries, you know? And it has something to do with, I suppose, insecurity. And I couldn't make the leap when I saw acting, whether it was on stage or in film or television, I couldn't make the leap that just me, Nick Offerman, was worthy of being among this work.
Uh-huh.
Because I grew up in such a cultureless little town. Like, I hadn't cottoned to the fact that what I naturally was, my personality, is true and valuable and absolutely the most valid thing I have. I subconsciously devalued myself.
Like the idea that you would go into a room and you'd be like, I don't really belong with these people.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of it, but I was just trying too hard. And so I got cast in shows because I could make people laugh, I could get a laugh, and they'd be like, oh, they'd give them a part in the play. And then I'd be in the play, and I would, you know, try way too hard in the play in some way where I was like, I can't just act like me. I have to be way cooler than me. It wasn't a fear of what would happen. It was simply not trusting the tools that I had.
Right.
You know? 'Cause all these kids from Chicago had way cooler tools.
Final, sounds sexual.
It was sexual. I have stretch marks to prove it. But Joe, my best friend, in 93, we did this play called The Quarantine. And he made me audition like 3 times. And he kept gently nudging me just towards myself, towards naturalism. And I still, so he finally said, okay, you're getting the lead in this play. But even that was okay work. Like that was probably C+ at best. But he finally gave me the chance to try working it out. And that was when I started, and I'm still like, I don't know, I still watch my work. And you know, I think I don't understand. I don't know any performers that can watch themselves and be and say, yeah, he's amazing. Like, you know, nailed it. Perfect. Couldn't have done any better. When I watch myself in any medium, I'm just watching to see what I can still get better at. And to me, that's much more rewarding than
that's the craft.
Yeah, I mean that's life. I mean, if you ever like, all right, I'm done. Like I've perfected everything. I think that leads to bitterness, or you know, that leads to escapism. And
but I think what you're saying here, even in the way you describe not taking certain auditions or not doing CSI, is that you want the work is the ultimate reward, right?
It is, and that's totally Wendell Berry. Like, that's what I love about his whole ethos is, you know, what he's trying to remind the world of, among other things, is that living on a small farm and raising agriculture and a family and being part of your community and being a steward of this piece of land is, and he's so right, is just as rewarding, if not more so, than any of these, like, 20th century, you know, winning awards or driving a BMW or all these things that consumerism have taught us are the goals. When I went to see him to interview him for my book Gumption, it was in the middle of a crazy schedule, and he was aware of that. You know, we like managed to nail down this Sunday afternoon, and he said, "So where do you go from here? Are you still running around?" And I said, "Yeah, you know, I'm hustling right now, and it's a lot of fun. But that's so that eventually I can take it easy." And he said, "Why would you ever take it easy? If you enjoy what you're doing, why would you ever stop? What's the point? That's completely antithetical." And I was like, "Oh, you're totally right." And it's something that we've been sold is like, work really hard, buy all of our products, and then you can retire. Well, you know, you have this much time to do some good. So why would you be like, well, I'm going to do good for 25 years and then you can all go fuck yourselves. So I feel like our society has become so comfortable. I feel like we're being slowly coddled into becoming like those fat people in the movie WALL-E.
Yes.
That float around and
yes.
Drink the shakes. You know, we're inventing cars that we don't have to drive anymore. Like that I find so upsetting. Because in my life, one of the greatest pleasures is commanding this vehicle that I worked really hard and bought this quality vehicle with all these features, and to take that away from me so you can what? Like, what are you gonna do when your car is driving itself? Like, fucking play
you get
a game
Instagram
on your phone?
People.
Yeah,
yeah.
Like, driving is the greatest.
I totally agree.
But it's a great analogy. Like, we're slowly being, yeah, I feel like it's very Orwellian. We're slowly being, you know, turned into these soft sheep so that we'll just continue consuming and, you know, and then it'll be the Matrix. And
I think WALL-E will look like a documentary to future people.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
Well, okay, let's switch gears a little bit because I want to talk about The Founder, which is a film you have coming out. And for people who don't know, it stars you, yourself, and Michael Keaton. And
it actually stars Michael Keaton and myself.
Yeah, okay. Well,
I'm contractually obligated to say that.
Well, it stars Michael Keaton and yourself. And it is a film that basically chronicles the way that McDonald's became a worldwide phenomenon. But unlike a lot of films told through the filter of American ingenuity, it's a more, in some ways, depressing tale about ruthless business practices and the fact that the business side can win out over a couple of people, you know, Dick McDonald and his brother, who were artists in a lot of ways. And you played Dick McDonald, who came up with all the systems that made McDonald's what it is. And Ray Kroc, who we all know as the McDonald's guy, didn't come up with a single thing. And it's sort of that classic David versus Goliath thing, but David doesn't win in this one. And I wondered about when you read the script, what spoke to you about it?
It's interesting. I get this call that they want me to do this part in this movie. And they said, you know, it's about Ray Kroc, it's about McDonald's. And my first thought was, have they read my book? Gumption had just come out, and the first thing in Gumption says something about the purveyors of the McShit sandwich.
Right.
and I was like,
that's gonna come up at some point.
Yeah, do they know about me and my feelings about this? And so I read the script, and the script is a very simple historical, you know, biographical telling of the inception of when Ray Kroc met the McDonald's and how McDonald's, you know, got started, which is not a pretty story, you know?
It's not a pretty story.
It's a dark story. And so once I read that, I was like, oh, yeah, great. And I just was thrilled. I mean, I'm such a big fan of Michael Pollan, but before him, Eric Schlosser wrote that great book, Fast Food Nation. And
yeah.
You know, this journalistic movement that's telling us, it's all of the same stripe. Like, we are such animals that we were so excited to get fast food. And it took us decades to start to be told, this is really not good for us. And even then, it took a couple more decades where it was like, you guys, here's a whole book of how bad this is and how they lobby the FDA to let them get away with selling us food that's bad for us so they can make money. And that's something that's going on that's so prevalent in modern America and now the world, that there are so many products that we shouldn't be able to buy, but the industries, the corporations have paid off our government because everybody's making money. They're like, hey, this kills people, but we're getting rich, so let's not make any rules about it. And that just speaks to me on a really human level where I'm like, okay, well, I know where I come down, and anything I can do to help promote the people that are sort of blowing the whistle and telling the truth about this, I want to be supportive. So I was thrilled to be asked to be a part of this story, but also to like work with Michael Keaton and John Carroll Lynch, you know.
Sure.
And now that I've seen the film, I'm fascinated by it because Ray Kroc, you can really look at him through a couple of different lenses. On one hand, from a humanistic point of view, he's a terrible guy. He's a horrible, insensitive monster. And on the other hand, looking at him through the business section, he's a hero. He's a champion of Western civilization.
Well, that's the beauty of the film, is that at the beginning, if you don't know the story intimately about what happened, as I didn't, you think, oh, this is one of these good old-fashioned American ingenuity stories. And then you realize, oh, it's like the fiction of the Indians and the pilgrims sitting down at Thanksgiving dinner.
Sure.
You know, it's the story we've been told all our lives. And I think that aspect of the film really makes you think about a business practice that can take anyone's ideas and anyone's intellectual property and make it their own. I mean, there had to have been some parallels that you drew in your head between the film business and
sure.
And this story.
Absolutely. The fascinating thing to me is that I can't really blame Ray Kroc because he couldn't help himself. And if he hadn't done it, there were tons of other people lined up. It was a movement, you know, where all of these entrepreneurs were trying, they were on the cusp of this. Taco Bell started at the same time, Burger King started at the same time. They were like, there's some way we can get rich feeding people crappy food fast. And they all jumped on it, and they were, you know, Ray Kroc was this sad, like, mixer salesman that was just, he knew that he was on the cusp, like he was looking for a get-rich-quick scheme, and he saw this, and he saw what it could become, and there was no way he could be stopped. He didn't mean to screw anybody.
No, I think Mac and Dick are just detritus on the road of progress, of you know, but still, to humanize those stories in a way. And you know what's interesting about your character? I don't think you smile once in the whole film. Like, there's a knowingness that your character has about what's going to happen, even if maybe you can't articulate it. But you know that this is wrong. And you had to play that role so close to the vest. It seems like there was a lot of restraint in that role. Is that something that immediately stuck out, that you're going to have to serve this story?
I suppose. I mean, I understand how this happened and how society was primed to be like, oh, we throw away the dishes? Bring it on. Like, this is amazing. We deserve this, you know? It's the New Deal. But now, you know, 50, 60 years later, we're absolutely still wallowing in the effects of that. And there's so much government policy that has come from that wealth that was created there that we're still allowing to happen. You know, we have factory farming, for example, or like, and again, it always comes back to Wendell Berry for me, but small farmers have been crushed in exchange for industrial farming, where they cover all the acres with corn or soybeans, which nature can't sustain it.
Right.
Eventually, it's going to crash. The soil will be ruined. You're going to have to keep pumping more chemicals into it. And so, you know, it's always a human problem. Neither side is completely right, but we have to find a balance that comes back from the world of McDonald's and says, it was really fun to not have to cook for 50 years, but you might want to think about cooking. You might want to think about growing a garden and see how healthy your family is. And that's, again, it all comes back to the same concept. The time you're saving going to a fast food restaurant, for what? Like, cooking the meal with your family and creating the food with your family, that's as rewarding as any work you can ever do.
Are you saying the inception of McDonald's was where the country went off the rails?
I think it's one of the great harbingers of you know, I think that was where we veered into a ditch, certainly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, it's a great history lesson in a lot of ways for the future, and you know, to be able to go back to when things started, when it did seem sort of innocent.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Oh, this milkshake, it tastes almost as good as the other milkshake, and it's powdered and it's easier and we don't have to have refrigerators and we'll save money on electricity.
Yeah, no, it's a no-brainer.
It's a no-brainer.
And that scene, like the most poignant scene perhaps in the entire wonderful series of Mad Men, was when they had a picnic and just then threw their trash down a hillside. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
They have a picnic and you're like, oh yeah, it wasn't that long ago that we were like, throw your stuff out the car window. And then eventually we were like, hey, you guys, maybe we shouldn't throw our garbage.
And we're still doing it.
I'm sure, you know, given the communities, you know, the Whole Foods mentality and those of us that have any sort of just simply awareness of a green mentality, I think in the whole of the American population, we're still considered to be the yoga hippie freaks, are like, oh great, are you eating tofu also? Like
he said in Santa Monica with no shoes on.
That's right.
On the black and white television show.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know.
Choir, meat preacher. No, I think that it's funny hearing you talk about the film in this way, which I didn't totally expect either. But hearing you talk about it, it's so in line. It sort of points out that the projects you're picking and are able to do, you know, are in line with the very idea of you having the confidence to become you. Like, I think about Parks and Recreation and that you were able to come onto a show with some comedy, you know, geniuses like Amy Poehler and people like Rob Lowe that have been doing it forever. And it seems like you not only got an education through that, but also going in later, becoming a success later in life and not having it happen to you when you were 25 on Friends or whatever. And I think that hearing you talk about the founder and hearing you talk about these things, there's a restlessness in you to make sure that you take a bigger look at the picture and, you know what I mean?
I do. I definitely always want to keep moving forward until I can't move anymore. And you're absolutely right. When Parks and Rec ended, I got offered some nice jobs, like, let's do a TV series where you're a sheriff with a mustache and you love meat. You know, and all these different ideas that somehow were springboarding off of Ron Swanson.
That weren't really ideas at all, probably.
Well, no, I mean, some of them, they were, you know, there were some quality people. And I had to laugh and say, you know, it's funny, like, all I would ever want in a career is for you to want to do a show with me. And at this moment, the only thing I don't want to do is another show. And in 3 years, when I'm ready to do another show, I'll call you and you won't take my call because I'll be history. But that's life. So if I, you know, if I do 20 other parts that are different, I'll hope that they do some good. You know, I'm grateful already, but it is a great comfort knowing that if for whatever reason I stop getting hired by showbiz, that I can always do theater, I can always make stuff in my shop. And now I can hopefully write something.
Well, it's fascinating that you use hobby sort of as a word that isn't worthy, and you use discipline instead of hobby.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of people do have one main thing and a bunch of hobbies. And I think what's really amazing and noble about you is that you have disciplines and that you've put enough time into them that yeah, you can write. And I imagine you can write as many books as you want to write. I don't know, I'm reminded of this section of American Ham where you're on stage and you're telling people, don't stop with me and my wood shop in Los Angeles. Like, go out and find all the local artisans in your own communities and go see what they do, go watch them. And in a way, you're inciting your audience to act. And I think I found out through watching and reading all of this that I think the difference between what you're doing and a stand-up routine is that you're sort of imparting some wisdom that people didn't even maybe expect to get. People come to see the mustache and Ron Swanson, and maybe they walk away going, you know what, I'm going to go learn how to blow glass or something.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I like that you said that I am trying to incite my audience to act. And that's all I want to impart with stuff like American Ham is just find people who know what they're doing. And even if what they're doing is making pasta and you are gluten intolerant, you still will receive the magic of someone doing something in the physical world that you can't help but say, that's pretty goddamn neat what you just did. And it makes me, either I'm gonna make pasta or I'm gonna do something entirely different, but that's what I'm railing against us losing in the human race. Like, I feel like the more we become homogenous and we all just like play the same game on our phones or whatever, I think that is the demon that's taking away the magic of humanity, which is these opposable thumbs,
yeah,
with which we can do so much more than that.
It's like I say, I had such an education just delving into your life, and it's inspiring, and it's fascinating to talk to you. So thank you for taking the time.
Thanks for letting me flap my gums.
Yeah, you did some good flapping. Well, let's go chop some wood.
All right.
All right. Hey folks, that's our show today. Thanks for listening. And before we tell you about next week's guest, I just want to take a minute and thank you all for tuning in to Off Camera. We are having a great season, and with every one of these conversations I have, I feel like the luckiest person in the world because I get to sit in this chair and have these conversations with these amazing artists, and I learn something new every time we do it. And I hope you do too. And listen, if you have any comments, criticisms, suggestions, ideas, you just want to drop me a line and say hi, please do. My email address is sam@offcamera.com, and I would love to hear from you. And if you love the show, please don't keep it a secret. Tell all your friends about Off Camera so we can keep bringing you these conversations. Thanks for listening. And before you go out and build your own canoe, make sure you mark your calendars for next week.
when I sit down with actor and director Ewan McGregor.
If you want it to be magic, which is what I think it is, there has to be an element of risk that it's only going to happen then, standing on the location in the costume and you start trying it. That's key for us actors, because you have to feel safe in finding the wrong thing. You have to do stuff that sucks because you have to know that it doesn't work.
When a kid leaves school at 16 to pursue acting with absolutely no training, that's rolling the dice, folks. But audiences worldwide witnessed the payoff as he quickly became one of the most successful actors around. Things were going well until he found a story he wanted to tell so badly he had to gamble again, this time as a director. If it meant a Scotsman taking on the greatest living American writer, well, where there's no risk, there's no magic. And for Ewan McGregor, where there's no magic, there's usually no point. Ewan joins me to talk about his early days in theater, his relationship with Trainspotting director Danny Boyle, and the agony and the ecstasy of making American Pastoral. See you next time, off camera.